50s for like 2 weeks now. March.
You need snow? Why, you want to go skiing?
Pardon?
You need snow? Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's really bad. Oh, well.
You want to go skiing? Is that what it is?
Well, yeah, I live in Vail, so it's...
Oh, my God.
The last month of March, it's been no snow and warm weather.
Oh, wow.
Really bad.
Like, it really seems like the weather is really kind of mixed up all over the place.
Yeah, like the East Coast is getting a lot of snow. And
yeah, yeah. Who else is on this evening? Who else would like to say hi?
Julie from Toronto.
Hey, Julie, how's it going?
Very good, thanks.
Good. Anybody else on who would like to say hello?
Kim, it's Caroline Smoyer from Toronto.
Oh, hey, Caroline, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear yours.
I hope everything's going well for you.
Everything is going great.
Oh, good, good.
Hello.
Somebody else would like to say hello?
Hello from Ottawa. Jean-Marie.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, who's there?
Jenny Linnell, New Jersey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Good.
Hello from Ottawa. Jean-Marie.
Oh, hi, Jean-Marie. How are you?
Is this Kim?
Yes, it is.
Hello. Fine.
Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah.
Is it warm there now?
Not too warm. Still snowing on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to say hi? Joe, are you on yet? Okay, we'll wait a few more moments.
Okay, this is Ahmed here.
Oh, hey, Ahmed, how is it going?
Good, glad, looking forward to hearing your conference.
Oh, good, okay, well, just for those people who don't know Ahmed Karim, Dr. Karim actually was the guest speaker for our last teleconference call. It was actually a very good call, he shared a lot of very interesting, very charming, very insightful stories about Drs. Kent and Dr. Grimmer and Kent's repertory, and I think it was a very informative, very enlightening conversation.
Thank you, Kim.
So, anybody else on who'd like to say hi?
As we're yes, Kim, I'm Dr. Krishna.
Oh, hey, you're back from India.
Yes, back from India after 6 weeks.
Fantastic. Did you have a nice time?
Yes, I had a nice time.
Okay,
I only
good.
Returned the day before, so I missed everything.
Don't worry about it. So, Joe, are you on yet?
Kim, real quick, what number do we press to mute?
Don't worry about muting. I'm going to be in charge of muting. So we now have it set up where I'm able to mute out everybody except for the person that's being interviewed.
Okay, so. That's Allison.
Hey, Allison, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good. I guess it's just getting close to actually 5 o'clock. So.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Kim. It's Beth calling from Toronto.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Mm-hmm. Nice to hear from you.
Good, yeah.
Hi, this is Barbara from Marin.
Hey, Barbara, how's it going?
Good.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Is this?
Oh,
am I on the right conference call?
You do. You are on the right conference call. I just heard the speaker, the interviewee. I just heard his voice. So Dr. Kellerstein has now joined us.
Okay.
And so what I'm going to go ahead and do now is I'm going to mute everybody out.
Okay.
The format of this call will be similar to other calls that we've conducted where I will conduct a formal interview for the first 45 minutes or so, and then I will unmute the number and allow people to ask questions for the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay.
So I want to thank everybody, first of all, for being on the call, and let me go ahead and mute the line now. And Joe, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Well, first of all, let me thank you so much on everybody's behalf for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to join us for this one-hour interview. Let me just give you a quick introduction. Dr. Kellerstein is somebody that I first heard about in my travels to Toronto. I would go to Toronto frequently for business purposes, and I visit a lot of different homeopathic schools, and I would repeatedly hear Dr. Kellerstein's name come up in the conversation as being this very gifted homeopath, this great teacher. And it seemed that a lot of the schools would basically bring Dr. Kellerstein in to do case-taking, case analysis, to really explain the organon in depth and to really provide a foundation. in the fundamental principles of homeopathic practice. And so I heard this name all over the place, and, you know, all these different students all over the Toronto area just basically singing Dr. Kellerstein's praises. And then a few years ago, I had the good opportunity to actually meet him in person, and those expectations I had were completely fulfilled in the person that I found, who was really just had such a depth of understanding and such a passion for homeopathy, and really so much commitment to wanting to promote really good, inductively oriented homeopathy, really deal with the more difficult issues in practice, issues regarding case management and long-term follow-up. These are the issues that seasoned practitioners are often challenged by. And Dr. Kellerstein, who's I think one of his primary teachers, is Andre Sain, has really in himself really pursued and furthered, I think, our understanding of the really important issues in being a successful practitioner. So without further ado, let me just welcome you. And before I go any further, though, let me just mention that Dr. Kellerstein will be offering a class in the Toronto area on May 29th and May 30th. It's entitled Acute and Emergency Prescribing with Differential Materia Medica. As you'll find out from this call, Dr. Kellerstein is a very dynamic speaker on top of being very, very knowledgeable. And his associate, who's a very classically trained veterinarian homeopath, will be also offering a seminar the following week, June 5th and 6th. Her name is Monica Froman, and that will also be in the Toronto area. You can find information about those events on the Whole Health Now events calendar. You'll see if you go to those dates, you'll find out more information. So without further ado, Dr. Kellerstein, thank you so much for joining us on the call tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay. Well, I thought I would start off by, you know, a question that I ask a lot of our speakers is to just give us a little bit of a sense of their approach in their schools, in the way that they teach. You know, what is it that they specifically do that's of value or contribution to the homeopathic science and art?
It's a very difficult question. I think you'd have to ask the students primarily to see whether there is any value in what I do. The value in what I do, Kim, will only arise as a result of training good homeopaths. Mm-hmm. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see practitioners arise who, in a matter of a year or two or three after graduation, are going to come back and they're going to teach me some. They're going to say, you know what, Joe, you told us this. I've managed through practice, careful observation, inductive reasoning, and then testing. This is what I found. You were wrong, or here's what I have to add to it. That will be the test. But to make it a little more apparent as to my approach, I never really considered myself a true teacher. I'm no master. I'm a passionate student. I continue to be a passionate student, and anything, any way that I teach arises solely as a result of the difficulties I've had in pursuing the practical applicability of homeopathy, making it hit the road, making it work. I found that so, so difficult. You know, in the early years of my practice, I think I first started to practice homeopathy in 82. And good teachers were truly a scarcity. Many of the concepts that we had were not transparent. They were not easily usable. You know, there were a lot of beliefs, a lot of homeopathic mythology floating around. I found that when I had practice with these things, you know, things may have worked once or twice. Certain ideas from certain teachers may have worked. But in the long run, the tools weren't flexible. They weren't easily utilizable, and ultimately frustrating. So in the end, I found, you know what? We've got to go back to the original sources. We've got to go back. We must study the organon. We must study the original provings. We've got to go back, and we've got to study the old literature, the cases available from the great masters, from Bozier, from Lippe, from Guernsey, from Benninghausen. And we've got to be able to glean what they have to teach us. The problem is that You know, my goodness, you look at the Organon. Most students who begin to study the Organon, who are left in some way on their own to really study it in depth, find that the Organon is probably the greatest cure for insomnia available. Right? A few aphorisms and you are out like a light. And my God, to read the introduction, I don't think so. So, once while lecturing to a class, I decided, you know what? I'm not going to assign any of the Organon for reading, because I know what's going to happen. We're going to study it sentence by sentence in class. We're going to sit there until each of the concepts, at least insofar as I can understand them, become transparent. That is, they can use the idea, they can grasp it, they can take it to work with them. So that formed the foundation of the way I decided I needed to teach. First, by educating myself and the Organon, educating students in such a way as to make it a friendly book. Secondly, we needed expertise in the technology. We need the technology of homeopathy, as you well know more than I, rests around the repertory, rests around how do we access what it is we get in the case and match it to the literature. The intermediary in that process is the repertory. We must master the repertory on the basis of the philosophy as is taught in the Organon, and that takes a lot of years. It takes a lot of practice. The next aspect is the ability to question. Without, you know, Hahnemann teaches us in a wonderful article that every person who studies homeopathy must read, called The Medical Observer. Now, I don't know where originally it was located, but I know these days The Medical Observer is located as an article at the beginning of Materia Medica Pura. I think it's volume 2 in the Indian edition, if I'm correct. It's only a 4 or 5 page article, but it outlines the mindset of the homeopath perfectly. It also outlines a lot of beautiful things. It says that in a physician, it's rare to meet a good observer, an impartial observer, one who approaches the case without a paradigm. He says, to be a good physician, he recommends certain studies. The first one being the study of Socrates, the Greek philosopher, in order to know how to study, how to help the patient give birth to their own concepts, ideas, feelings, altered feeling and function. He says a good homeopath should study how to do a nature drawing so as to be accurate in drawing the lines of what they see. Should study mathematics in order to learn precision. And music in order to learn themes, recurrences, etc. It's a beautiful, beautiful article. This forms the basis of my teaching. The second component is the experience of success. During our classes, what I insist we do...
So I'm sorry to interrupt you for a second. Are you using a headphone or a speakerphone?
No, I'm not. I do notice the echo, though.
You do notice it. Okay. All right. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's quite all right. It seems to be floating in and out, so I don't know what that might be. I'm not using the speaker.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll just go on then.
Yeah.
Thanks.
During the process of classes, it's extremely important that a student get a sense of success. So I've developed a problem-centered learning base using bite-sized cases from the literature that can act as the focus of an entire learning routine, where first we study the case. We break it down, we determine what the genius of the case is, we go to the repertory, learn the rubrics, learn about the pathology, the prognosis, how to decide what might be characteristic in the case. All of this in about 15, 20 minutes, then we move on to the next case. That way there's a repetitious feel that is developed of what is the genius, how do we access it, how do we access the technology, how do we do a differential diagnosis, and then how do we confirm or evaluate what's going on in the follow-ups. That's essentially the program and the routine and my approach to it. I approach it as I approach an actual case in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I make sure that students have access to me. I want a student to be able to come and watch me practice if they so desire, to question me as to what I've done, and to make sure, again, that the whole process is transparent, that they see what we teach is what we do beginning to end. They see how we succeed and how we fail.
Joe, you know, I think this is so important. You know, there's so many practitioners out there who, you know, themselves are excellent practitioners but have not been able to instruct their students in such a way that they're able to duplicate the success of the master practitioner. And I think this is the feedback I hear from a lot of your students, is that you do really give them the tools to be able to basically do exactly what you're doing themselves, and not only just to do it themselves, but actually to do it better than the way you're doing it. And I really want to commend you on that. I think it's fantastic. I was just hoping that before I ask any more questions, you could just define a couple of terms. For people who may not be familiar, you use the word genius, and I assume you're using it the way that Stuart Close uses it. I thought maybe you could just clarify that, the meaning of that word. And also, we talked a little bit about an inductive method. I thought perhaps you could just clarify, the importance of the inductive method to homeopathy, and just maybe a quick explanation of what that's all about.
You bet. So first of all, the term genius. Genius, essentially, in homeopathy, is the minimum syndrome of maximum value. Those symptoms in the case that have the greatest characteristic value, i.e. those things that will ultimately be able to lead you to and identify a remedy with the greatest similitude. So really, the concept here is always foreground, background. You know, for example, if you have a case of pneumonia, cough, fever, chills, difficulty breathing are all common to the syndrome of pneumonia. What we're looking for is to put the pathology as the background. Into the foreground come those incidental or peculiar symptoms that identify the reaction of the individual. So, you know, the intense thirst, or nausea during the fever, the chill, all the time during the whole process. Nausea with a clean tongue. These things become characteristic more of the patient than of the pathology, and therefore form the genius of the case and lead us to a remedy that must necessarily lead us in a curative direction. How's that?
That was great. Yeah, I'm glad that we should write that down and put that in our definition on our website. So that was very, very good. Thank you.
Okay, now induction. This is a huge one. This is huge. So induction. So first of all, Kim, let me ask you, where did the name, the Organon, come from?
Well, I know that the original is from Aristotle, but that Hahnemann took it from Francis Bacon's Novum Organum.
And in the Novum Organum, what was described?
The inductive method.
Right, which ultimately became known as the scientific method.
True.
So Hahnemann, and if you go back in the old literature, the old Hahnemannian monthlies, where some of the really great old guys, and again, you know, I'm going to stop here for a second and just give you a commercial, because the new package with all those old journals on them is really ruining my marriage. I'm staying up nights. I'm reading this. It's just wonderful. Thank you so much.
I'm glad you like it, yeah. Okay.
But the idea of induction is this. We begin with a great humility. We begin with a great understanding of, you know, no matter how much I ever know, what I know is nothing compared to what I don't know. And we have to have an incredible, incredible reverence for our own ignorance. Our own ignorance is the source of all creativity. The darkness of that ignorance is the source of all inspiration and of all possibility. If we fill our minds with our own egos, with our own theories, then the cup is full. There's no room for anything else. Now, we know that in the history of science, we know that 99.99% of all theories ultimately proves to be wrong. All speculations. So to begin with a reverence for that ignorance is the basis of all good science and all good medicine. So in induction, we first gather facts as if we had picked up something from an archaeologic site. We dust it off. We try to define its outline by asking critical questions. We try to make sure that what we see is actually what we have. And we come to no conclusions, no theories, no speculations, no paradigms. We just add facts as they're carefully dusted off, put on the desk, until we're forced to see a particular insight. That insight is then put to the test by practical application. That's inductive reasoning. Now, Francis Bacon was wonderful. And I didn't know how wonderful until I started reading some of it. And you know, in his philosophy, he describes what we must purge ourselves of in order to achieve inductive reasoning. He was wonderful. You know, Bacon first said, you know, we've got to throw away all of our old knowledge because it is garbage. And he said, in no field of endeavor is the garbage greater than in the field of medicine. Bacon was the first person I ever read to talk about disease as a misattunement of the life force. Bacon also said that when we come to inductive knowledge, we got to get rid of certain ghosts in our mind. He talked about the ghost of the cave. We got to get rid of the ghost of the cave when we're thinking, what's the ghost of the cave? The ghost of the cave are our personal prejudices and ideas that we have that we come to in our aloneness, our fears, our anxieties. Then he said we got to get rid of the ghosts of the marketplace. What are those? Well, you know, we all got to get along in life. We've all got to make a buck. And in doing so, we develop certain ideas that are common. We got to get rid of those ideas. We've got to get rid of the ghosts of the tribe. That means our culture or the background we come from that tends to develop certain mythologies or beliefs that are never tested. And at this point, I think it's salient to introduce the idea of a belief. What is a belief? David Bohm defined belief in the most beautiful way I've ever heard. He said, it's an idea we hold close to our heart and therefore shield from the light of day, from investigation. So he said, if we can get rid of these and deal only with the pure facts, the facts will lead us to insights around nature. And that's the whole approach of homeopathy. When you sit down with somebody at a case, if you think, I'm going to find the mentals in this case, if you think, I'm going to find the essence, the delusion, the whatever, you're automatically now not practicing homeopathy. If you later decide to apply those as an emphasis in analysis, that's another thing. But when you sit down with the patient, there is no paradigm. You are allowing yourself to be led. You must be totally flexible. You allow the patient and you facilitate the process of helping that patient sculpt out his own reality, his own case, his own altered feeling and function set. He defines what is characteristic, not a book. And in homeopathy, that's induction.
Thank you for that very eloquent definition of that term. You just made me want to ask you a whole bunch of questions about all kinds of different things, including you know, David Baum and quantum physics and all that. But I will move on to asking you, you know, focusing on the topic of the call tonight, which is follow-ups. And so really what I'd like to, the first question I'd really like to ask with regards to that is, what is really necessary, you know, because I think this is an issue in homeopathic practice that people don't really understand the real importance of. There's a lot of issues there, and I'd like to know what you think are the essential elements or prerequisites that are involved in conducting a good follow-up interview.
You know, the structure of the follow-up, being expert in the follow-up, is a huge portion of the art of homeopathy. But if we step back, we say, well, what is the follow-up? What is the function of the follow-up? The idea of the follow-up is to see what has changed. What shift, what transformation, what metamorphosis has occurred since the first visit. So really, what we're looking for is what has changed. In order to know, in great detail, subtlety, both from a left and a right brain perspective, what has changed, everything depends upon our reference structure. What's the reference structure? The reference structure is the initial case. You can't have a follow-up or a good follow-up without a wonderful initial case. What's that mean? There has been so many different kinds of teaching as to what constitutes the initial case. To me, we need to first sculpt out with precision all of the chief complaints. I don't mean this is the order of it, but once we're through, we need to have each of the chief complaints, each of the syndromes, as they're called, need to be sculpted out in exquisite detail. We need a very clear etiology, onset, course, and pace. We need to know the location, the sensation, the modalities, the concomitants.
So I'm just going to ask you to speak up a little bit because your voice is getting a little muted.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We need to have these sculpted out in great detail. We need to know for each of the syndromes, for each of the modalities, what provokes it, even on the mental and emotional level. What are the stressors? Then we need to have a wonderful general case with all of the thermal modalities, all of the generals that we already know, including a wonderful mental and emotional case. In the acquisition of that, we need, you know, Hahnemann in the Medical Observer, again, says something of the utmost importance here. He says, when you perceive something, doubt yourself and doubt the patient as to what the precision is of what it is they're feeling. Let me give you an example. A patient through the course of may come to you with a sciatica. And this has happened many, many times. They come with a sciatica, and just as a made-up example, the patient says, it's always worse when I lay down at night. Well, we have to learn to question that. If we take it and without question, we may take it erroneously. For example, I had a student with me, and we had such a situation. The patient said that I do have a sciatica, and it's always worse at night. I said, it's worse at night. Yes. Exactly when at night do you notice it to be worse? Well, I notice it worse when I lay down in bed. It's around 11, 12 o'clock. And does it matter what position you're in? Well, yes, it would seem that it's when I lie on my side, my left side. That's interesting. What if you were to lay down on your left side in the daytime? Well, come to think of it, I did, and it does hurt. So it's no longer worse at night when lying. It's worse any time when lying on the left side. Well, what if pressure in any position is applied? Well, come to think of it, if I lean against a wall, it's the same thing. Or the other evening, my wife just shoved me, and yeah, it was this, so it's worse from pressure. So suddenly we have a transmutation of the original spontaneous explanation of what the symptom is based on a careful questioning. It's very important. So the reference structure, the precision of the reference structure is extremely important. But at the same time, we have to know how not to sacrifice the artistic totality of what the patient is expressing. We have to learn how to capture the broad strokes of that patient's presentation, their complexion, their posture, their demeanor, your impressions of them, how they affect you internally. All of these count, the extreme right brain, the extreme left brain concepts. Without precision in that initial reference structure, we have nothing. That is the most important basis for the follow-up.
Very, very interesting. Can you give us a sense when you do the follow-ups, how long you're taking and what are your primary focuses, or how complete are you, or just or timing of it? Can you give us a sense of that whole aspect of the follow-up interview?
Sure. When I was first in practice, a follow-up interview took me about a half an hour to 45 minutes. These days, it's about 15, 20 minutes, depending upon the number of chief complaints, the number of syndromes, and the number of characteristic symptoms that I'm revealing. So when I sit down with a patient, and that brings up a very good question, so that the other aspect is when you sit down for a follow-up with a patient, it's up to the physician or the homeopath to set the frame, the context. So you don't ask, what's happening, or how are you doing, or how did that remedy work? The question that I found most resourceful is, what has changed since I last saw you? Right away, we've created a frame where information can flow in regarding any shift. That's the emphasis. Following that, I review each symptom, beginning with the symptoms I judge to be the most characteristic. That is, after the patient has given, you know, his spontaneous rendition of anything that's changed, and you go, of course, what else, what else, what else? And then you review the entire case. That way, you've got an extremely clear perspective as to, you know, what about the mental-emotional has shifted? How has the physical shifted? Is there anything new and different? Is it an old return of symptoms, or is it something new? Has there been an interrupting syndrome, an incidental syndrome that maybe has thrown a wrench into everything?
I was talking earlier today to another homeopathic student, and they were describing a scenario where they had a patient who had been prescribed for by two different practitioners. And the first practitioner had given the remedy primarily for the physical pathology in the case. They had used just the symptoms of the physical pathology, pretty much disregarding the mental-emotional state and even, I think, maybe the general physicals in the case. And there was, from that prescription, some improvement in the physical symptomology, but the general picture of the case pretty much stayed the same, and even though there was an improvement on the local level, there wasn't much of a change. So the person went and saw another practitioner, and that practitioner gave a remedy that seemed to be primarily designed to address the mental-emotional state of the person and largely disregard the physical picture, the physical pathology, and the result was that the physical pathology was exactly the same, but overall the mental-emotional state of that individual had improved. They felt overall quite a bit better. I was curious what your perception or your analysis of those two different prescriptions might be. I know you don't really have a lot of information, but if you have any thoughts or ideas, or do you see a similar thing in your own practice, or any comments you might want to make about that?
Certainly. That's a great question, Kim. So, first of all, the question contains a presupposition of structure. The question contains the presupposition of, is there a primacy of physical? Is there a primacy of mental? And the answer to the question there has to be that the primacy in homeopathy is always on the genius of the case. That's why we have to be easily led. That's why we must approach a case without a paradigm that this is more important than that. That's the subject for case analysis. Now, most often, you know, will come up with the genius of a case. That is the most important symptoms in the case, the most characteristic or peculiar, those things that most define the reaction of the individual case of this problem. And usually it'll be somewhere between 3 and 7 symptoms, and it may contain 1 or 2 mental symptoms. Mostly, I will not want any remedy that I choose to in any way directly contradict the mental symptoms of the case. Hahnemann tells us that where the mental symptoms are especially characteristic, they become extremely important in the selection of the remedy. But very often, I find mental symptoms dicey. That is, they're able to be interpreted in one way or another. Whereas physical symptom, my God, can give us a kind of where it exists and where it is definitely peculiar. It can give us a kind of certainty that we can anchor ourselves on. If we look at Kunsley's repertory at the black dots, most of the black dots, those symptoms that Kunsley found and remedies that Kunsley found especially valuable when marked in the selection of the similimum, they're mostly physical symptoms. And a wonderful Indian homeopath, Sarabhai, had the best line I've ever heard. He said, where possible, I prefer to base my case on the peculiar symptoms of the physical level because I find I don't know my own mind, let alone someone else's. And really, I go wherever the case leads me. But I try to rest my case on the most certain symptoms so that when I go to the Materia Medica and read, I find a similitude that's extremely pleasing. That, of course, is the ultimate arbiter. You can, in your analysis, you can place your emphasis wherever you want, but if you're making your judgment based on a repertorization without going to Allen or Herring or Hahnemann for a final decision, what are you doing? You're not practicing homeopathy. You're just guessing from a repertory chart. And as we know, the repertory, even though it's a wonderful tool, is really predominantly ersatz. You know, it's a chopped up fish with all the different little parts put in different little places. We've got to go back to the actual complete symptom as it exists in the original literature to actually know if we have similitude. We can't know it based on a repertory chart.
You know, it's interesting you should say that. I've found that in a lot of cases, the actual when the patient will be describing their pathology, and you go back to the original provings, it's almost as if they were reading right from the original provings. Have you ever had that experience? And
that is part of the orgasmic experience of homeopathy. That, you know, when you find that, you know, just we had an acute case in class just last weekend. And I'll just very briefly do it for you. An individual came in and, you know, he's been working very hard at work. And he has a kind of clerical job. He's got a lot of tasks to do, one after the other, after the other, after the other. And recently his assistant had gone, so he had double the number of tasks. And people were asking a lot of questions. And he was finding it a huge burden. He was getting irritable. And from all of these tasks and the irritability, he was becoming weak. He found he was getting chilly at night and sweaty at night, and one day he woke up with a very severe backache. And the backache had a number of modalities that we don't need to go into. But what was fascinating was we added up all the modalities, and we did a nice, neat repertorization. We looked at the etiology. We developed a repertory chart, and then I assigned readings in Herring to each one of the students so that we could, after the fact, argue one for or against a remedy based on what we read in Herring and Allen. So we came down to a differential diagnosis, and, you know, we found under one remedy, you know, we had been looking at all the modalities, and we found a remedy that covered the modalities but not the etiology. And then suddenly in Herring, we find this thing that didn't repertorize at all under calcarb. And it said, backache after annoyance. No way would you have found that with repertorization. So the way to approach the old literature is with a degree of precision. I want this in my case, I want that in my case, but with an openness to being pleasantly surprised. And when we get a surprise like that, we know we found this amazing connection through nature with the vitality of a prover to the vitality of a patient we have. And you know the remedy is going to work.
Mm.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing to find it in the literature.
That's great. I love that answer. Okay. You know, I know a lot of people, especially in the early years of practice, but it definitely happens in the later years as well, will give a remedy to a patient, and then they'll come back in, and you'll ask them, how are they doing? And the first response will be, well, everything's the same. Nothing's any different. I thought maybe you could comment about what to do in those circumstances, and does that necessarily mean that nothing's happened, or, I mean, how do you interpret that whole very common situation?
That's the big one. So here we are. We've gone through years of education and thousands and thousands of dollars on equipment and books and whatnot. We've spent hours, you know, belaboring a particular prescription, and it's a few weeks later, and they're on their way through the door. And suddenly your ego is on the line here where it shouldn't be. And, of course, that's not the very Zen way of going about this. But it's time to bite some nails and do a little sweating. And then they sit down, and you say, please, God, please let them say that. They're all better. It's been a miracle. And they sit down, and you get the guts up to say, all right, what's changed since you last saw me? And they have this glum look on their face, and they're staring down a little, and they say, nothing. And you feel like packing it in. But, you know, don't. Don't. Let me back up again, and let me ask this. Have you ever been afraid, really afraid? What do you think, Kim? Have you?
Me, personally?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so do you notice anything about your field of vision or what might happen to it when you get afraid? Do you ever notice that?
Yeah, it gets a little more narrow.
Just a tad.
Yeah.
When you're afraid, when you're under stress, your perceptual scope narrows. That's why we ask questions. When you're afraid, all you're going to focus on is, am I better? Is it all gone? We have to hold that in mind before we let our ego shatter. The approach to that is this. Much, I would say, in my particular experience so far in practice, about 70% of the time, a patient will come back, and when I ask that question, they'll say nothing has changed. What they really mean is the one or two points of most intense anxiety haven't gone.
Right.
That's what they mean. That's why the reference structure is so important. So the person will come back and they'll say, oh, nothing has changed. No, no, no. Well, what about the 105 fever after 6 o'clock? Oh, that went. What about the dreams of robbers? Gone. It often goes like that. So hold to your guns. Hold to your reference structure. You know, it may well be that it's a wrong remedy. But one thing I found, that there's nothing wrong with giving a wrong remedy. If you give a remedy that at least has some degree of similitude, Kim, when you give it to them, they come back, you've got a highly meticulous initial case, you're going to find that just like sonar bouncing off a rock, you're going to get some feedback. And that feedback with a new symptom, a new sensation, something, is going to lead you far closer to a correct remedy.
You know, I think this is an incredibly important point that you're making. You know, oftentimes if you do give that remedy similar, you, as you said, they'll come back and there'll be these other indications for the best choice, remedy choice for that patient. And I think a lot of times people give up too early on. So I'm really glad you shared that, that way of being, having equanimity and, not getting freaked out about these patients who come in and say nothing's better when frequently things are quite a bit better. So thank you so much for sharing that wisdom with everybody. I know it's very valuable. Joe, you were mentioning earlier on about when you teach to your students that you use a lot of classical, a lot of old cases from the old literature, and I was just thinking maybe you could kind of share with us which practitioners you find have cases that are most useful for that type of work.
Benninghausen, but especially Lippe.
Mm-hmm.
Lippe has dozens and dozens and dozens of very small cases, each of which demonstrate a particular point that he loves to make in the literature, often in a very life-threatening situation. Lippe is wonderful. But, you know, it's also wonderful to go through all of the old journals, even the Indian journals, the homeopathic heritage. Go through cases even if you don't find them to be done very well, because they too have certain teaching points. Every case has several teaching points. And the question becomes, like, what is characteristic? And we can define characteristic, but ultimately, in order to learn what is characteristic, we've got to learn all the ways and means and inflections of how characteristic and peculiar symptoms can manifest in a real situation. And the only way to mock up a real situation is by learning from the old cases. Again, that's why the program is so valuable. Because you've actually allowed us to do that by collections of cases. I love the Pulfords, Lippe, Benninghausen, Bozier. It's all wonderful.
Okay. Just so people are aware, you're talking about Adolf Lippe, the father, and not Constantine Lippe, although I assume he would have some good cases as well.
I'm really unaware. Mostly, yes, he's Adolf Lippe.
Okay. All right, good. Okay, I think we don't have too much time. I think I would ask one more question, and then I'll open it up to the group. You had mentioned a little bit earlier on the idea of homeopathic thinking tools, and I thought maybe you could give us a couple examples of that and how you would use those.
Sure. A homeopathic thinking tool is what I've defined as a neatly tied up concept that I can take out tomorrow and use in practice. For example, in a recent lecture to my class, I defined some 11 or 12 homeopathic thinking tools that would be useful in assessment of the response to the remedy in the follow-up. For example, the first homeopathic thinking tool that actually we did the introduction to just before when we talked about the inductive method is homeopathic thinking tool number one, know when you don't know. Now, it sounds silly, it sounds trite, but how often do we not know that we don't have a case? You know, that we don't have truly dynamic symptoms that can actually productively lead us to a particular remedy. It's important to know when we don't know. When the cup is empty, we can fill it. When it's full, we can't. That's a thinking tool. Another thinking tool, the concept of antidote. So, have you read a great deal about what the antidote, in fact, is?
Well, a little bit, but, you know, why don't you go ahead and give us your definition and explanation of it?
Well, from my education and experience, you know, an antidoting factor is something that the patient has reacted to more than he's responded to the remedy. And the response to the antidoting stimulus caused a cessation of the response to the remedy. It's almost like having a TV set. The TV set plays only one channel. Initially, it plays the remedy channel. But, you know, the signal from the antidoting channel comes in much more strongly and causes a cessation. The most common antidoting factor in my experience and practice are strong emotional responses. Certain people, yes, will antidote to mint. Certain people will antidote to loss of sleep, to excess coffee. And, you know, we as homeopaths really dread antidotes. We feel it interferes with our treatment. But if we really reflect for a moment, as homeopaths, what we are most interested in is the profile of the patient's most striking susceptibilities. So that when we get an antidote in practice, when we get an antidotal response in some fashion in practice, we're actually making a new discovery of great importance. Here is a new, highly specific sensitivity of that patient. And when we investigate it, it becomes a whole focus of treatment itself. For example, we discover that a patient antidoted at jealousy. Well, it's something we may not have known in the case. When we add jealousy to the case, all of a sudden we see the remedy. It's actually a wonderful opportunity.
I've never heard it expressed that way, but that's a nice way to think of the antidotes as the allies. And so let me see if I can clarify this or understand it fully. Basically, what you're saying is I'm assuming you're saying not everyone will be susceptible to coffee, but if somebody is susceptible to coffee, that can give us a sense of what their potential chronic remedy is.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's a very nice explanation of antidotes and also a way to really make use of them as well. I think that's great.
And yeah, the point you raised and clarified, and thank you for that, is that antidotes, just like everything else in homeopathy, antidotes must be individualized.
Right.
And that by careful investigation, being Sherlock Holmes.
Sure, sure. I just had a curiosity. Do you find coffee to antidote a large percentage of cases? Or
no.
What's your experience? Not a large percentage.
No, not a large.
Yeah. If you were going to just give a number, what would you say?
I would say 15-20%.
15-20%. And mint, just out of curiosity, because I haven't seen that at all myself.
I'd say very small.
Very small, yeah.
Very small. Again, for me, the two most frequent kinds of antidoting responses are emotional stress, lack of sleep, overexertion.
And how do you address, do you give the patient some suggestions about how to stay calm, because they may be under circumstances that may create some type of stress that will antidote the remedy. I mean, how do you address that situation or deal with it?
Well, that's a fabulous point, because even in the Organon it says if you're going to be a real physician, you've also got to know which factors obstruct the cure and how to remove them.
Right.
So, many of the things that we do that are bad habits, whether it be in the way of lifestyle and food or emotional response, are things that, not dynamic, but things which have been trained into us. We need, as practitioners, to have developed methodologies or protocols to help patients look at their training and ways of facilitating them to help retrain themselves. Hahnemann says most mental illness is a result of hygienic factor, not dynamic factor.
Sure.
So, in that sense, I, for example, have taken a lot of training in NLP. Other people might find a different kind of practitioner to refer to or take some naturopathic training. But we need other tools. Homeopathy alone is not enough.
Right. Joe, thank you so much. I'm going to end the formal part of the interview, and I'm going to open it up to the general public, but I just want to personally thank you again for your intelligence, your wisdom, and also your friendship. So just thank you so much for that.
And you can. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
Hold on one second. All right. Are people ready for their questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Go ahead.
I'd like to find out, when you say that a remedy might be antidoted from emotions or issues like that, how do you know that it's actually an antidote as opposed to that they've moved on to another remedy or, the remedy that you gave them addressed the issues and this is now a new presentation?
Okay. That's a wonderful question. Actually, quite complex, too. I find that, first of all, the question of whether or not it's a new remedy or a new remedy picture will again depend on reference to the initial case, your reference structure. Someone has responded well to a remedy and are now complaining of an acute emotional response, you take the case. Certainly, if the case corresponds clearly to a particular remedy, you give the remedy on an acute basis. That's often the situation. If it's a new remedy picture, a new chronic remedy picture, there will be a change in the basic reference structure, the general case, the modalities, the temperature features, like that. If it is in fact an antidote, the response to the remedy has stopped, the case will ultimately roll backwards, or the case will roll backwards in the sense of what you have achieved in the way of gains may be somewhat lost, and the original case structure will simply reassert itself. The patient is still hot at night in bed, is still worse at 11 o'clock, and the sciatica that was better has gotten worse again.
Thanks, Joe. Let me unmute everybody again so that we can get the next question. One second. Okay.
Hello, Tim. Tim, I'm Dr. Joe. This is Dr. Luke here.
Oh, hey, Luke. How are you?
Very good. First of all, I want to commend Dr. Joe for his wonderful teaching that he does to his students, going back to the endocrine medicine of Hanuman. I was a little bit more expecting about management, since I just wrote a book of 450 pages just about management, so I was curious to hear what Dr. Joe has to say. And we did bring up at least one question about it, which was when, you know, when the patient does not respond, comes back and says, nothing happened. The drug for nothing happened. And he said, well, I must agree that the hypochondriac effect will always say that, you know, in our girls. But, you know, it just happened. I mean, that you're saying that this just happened. This is actually a scenario that is well described by Kant. And that is, it's my scenario number two. So the answer that Dr. Joe gave there is like, well, it maybe it was the wrong remedy. No, I must say there's about five different answers to that second scenario, but that's actually not the right answer, because it is not the wrong remedy, otherwise something would have happened. In other words, definitely new symptoms or accessory symptoms to the remedy would have come. So I would have liked to hear a little bit different response to that, I must say.
I'm having a hard time hearing you, Luke. I don't know if your phone reception, I don't know if anybody else is having a hard time hearing.
Tim, I could hardly make that out at all.
I could hardly make out what you were saying, I'm sorry to say.
Well, maybe let me try again.
Okay. Did you have something specifically that you would like Dr. Celestine to comment on?
I feel terrible, Kim. I couldn't hear.
I could hardly hear.
Okay, well, can I repeat again?
Go ahead.
Do you hear it better this time?
It's hard to hear you, Luke.
Well, it's too bad. I just wanted to hear a different response to that scenario that you actually said nothing happened, because the answer that I've given by Dr. Zero is actually a wrong answer, so I just wanted to see what else he thought about it.
Did you hear that, Joe?
No. I heard that Luke would like to hear a different response, but that's all I could make out.
He wants to hear a different response to the, when you said that nothing happened. He's found that it's similar in his experience, that oftentimes it is something that happens, but he wondered if you had a little more to say on that particular topic.
Well, especially that the answer was not right. I mean, the answer was, maybe it's a wrong remedy. That is not the right answer, because, you know, the patient would not say nothing happened.
And he was saying that the answer was not correct, and saying that it might have been the wrong remedy, because even if it was the right remedy, the wrong remedy, there would be some kind of response, you know, like a new symptom or you know,
a different... Or accessory symptom.
Yeah, what...
Did you hear that comment, Joe?
Well, I think I did cover more than one possibility there. Perhaps I was very unclear. The first thing is simply to hold your ground and to do a very thorough review of the case in all aspects and make your own assessment independent of what the patient is saying, certainly. But one of the possibilities is that despite a small shift, yes, there's almost always a small shift, I agree, that if the remedy did not strike the heart of the case, if there's not a quantum jump, it was the wrong remedy. That's very possible. A remedy with a degree of similitude insufficient to move the case in a really significant way. And that's a distinction I do make for myself.
Great. Other questions? Somebody have another question they'd like to ask?
Yes, this is Christina Chambreau.
Hey, Christina, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hi, good. Christina.
I'm wondering, I really appreciated your talking and how you lecture, Joe. It resonates well with what I do. I'm wondering, in terms of small remedies versus larger remedies, do you find using more polycrests or fewer polycrests and more new remedies or sticking with more of the original remedies?
Okay. I try to keep my cases quite independent of the concept of selection of remedies, although it does creep in. So predominantly what I do is I will choose what I perceive to be the genius of the case, and I'll try to sort of keep my mind cleansed of, as much as I can, being, you know, pretty weak, of determining that it may be a particular remedy. If I do find myself gravitating towards a particular remedy, what I try to do is disprove it. Next, in terms of polycrest versus smaller remedies, I do find that the majority of my cases are polycrests. And I find that only because I'm able to find a satisfactory similitude in the materia medica and get a very salutary result. So the vast majority of my cases, I would say, fall within the sphere of certainly the top 200 remedies, and more often the top 60 remedies. And, I see a lot of severe pathology in terms of the problems that patients present with, and it does just great. So I have no problem with large versus small remedies. Anything that works according to the case is fine by me. It's just my individual experience.
If I could just make a quick comment about this subject, it's one that I've thought about quite a bit. And here's my idea. I'd like to hear what your feelings are about it. My feeling is that there are certain remedies like the minerals, phosphorus and sulfur and calcarea and silica, that are just so fundamental to human physiology that it would just make sense that those would, as homeopathic remedies, be more commonly indicated in general practice than would be a more obscure substance that wasn't so much something that was part of our normal metabolic or physiological function. And I think that Hahnemann probably selected remedies based on the fact that they were, either minerals or medicines that had been used at that time or poisons. I mean, he had his reasons for selecting those remedies. I get the sense that there may be, as things change on the planet or there's cultural changes, that there may be different remedies that are indicated today than maybe were indicated 150 years ago because of changes, and maybe remedies that were polycrests back then are maybe not as commonly used today, or vice versa, there are remedies back then that were polycrests and were not polycrests, but maybe more commonly used today. And I guess my question is, what I've been thinking at least is that maybe what's happening is that people who are just using 200 remedies or 300 of the top remedies, they're having to maybe prescribe more remedies because they're not using a remedy that maybe would cover a larger totality of the case. Now, I'm just speculating here, but this is something I think a lot about, and I thought maybe you could comment on that.
Well, I think you're right. I think part of the genius of Hahnemann, I mean, why did he choose lycopodium?
Sure.
Why? And what about sepia? Because his artist friend was sucking on the brush?
Sure.
And with potentization, what about that? No, some of it was sheer genius, and then the results which followed. Yes, these are well-proven remedies so that we can find more pictures of similarity in them. They're more well-proven, but and I agree that it is the function of a good homeopathic profession to do more good provings, to develop those provings with clinical verifications, and ultimately yield to the profession a larger stock of well-proven, fully proven remedies. And I agree that as things evolve, we will be using more. And yes, what Hahnemann did in 4 or 5 remedies, Herring did with Lachesis in 1. So you're right. And I can only speak from my individual experience, which, yes, can be biased by my previous education, But as I said, I try to keep my assessment of the case, the genius of the case, and the selection of the remedy as independent as at least I'm capable of as being a very frail, biased human being. But I do find that the majority of my cases turn out to be Polycrest remedies.
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of practitioners who have the exact same experience. So, it's certainly a large experience within the homeopathic community. And an interesting question because, you know, you've got people claiming that they only use 200 remedies, and you've got some people claiming that they never use Polycrests. And then, so, you know, I think this creates a lot of confusion for new people in homeopathy to try to rectify, you know, those two positions. And
one other thing I'd like to make a point about, though, Kim, is that, you know, sometimes people will, out of a desire to have a vast knowledge of a huge stock of remedies, they'll say, well, why are you paying so much attention to the Polycrests? Those are so well known. And, you know, once I had a student who said, well, why would you want to use Polycrests? They're used all the time. Shouldn't we be using the smaller remedies? Everybody knows everything about the Polycrests. So I opened up, I grabbed a copy of Herring's Guiding Symptoms, and I opened it up, and I said, all right, look, I'm going to read a remedy. I'm not going to tell you what the remedy is, and I'm going to read from Herring's Guiding Symptoms, and I'm only going to read the black type symptoms. And after 5 or 10 symptoms, I want you to tell me what the remedy is, and I'll only read from the mental section. And you know, we went through, I'd say 7 of the top Polycrests, Sepia, Sulfur, Calcarb, and he couldn't get any one of them. Now, I have spent 20 years in practice. I've seen thousands and thousands of new patients, thousands of cases. I don't believe I can sit down and say to you, this is sulfur.
Sure.
My God, 5,000 symptoms?
Yeah.
Not to mention the inflections and the different types of people possible in those remedies.
Sure.
We can never say we know a remedy.
Very, very interesting stuff. Okay, so I see we're almost out of time. Let's have one more question, and then we'll end the call, so I'm going to unmute. One final question somebody would like to ask?
This is Barbara Juniper from California, from Marin. Thank you so much. I was really enjoyed the reminder about the flexibility, you know, that you have to maintain in that case taking and sitting as an unprejudiced observer, because I know in my own practice that when I can do that, my prescribing gets so much more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I receive the case, as he says, I receive it.
Exactly.
And thank you so much.
Oh, good. Well, why doesn't everybody say goodbye to Dr. Kellerstein?
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Yeah, oh, I just
didn't
want to mention before people get off the call, Dr. Kellerstein does have some audio CDs. Joe, could you just tell the group about the CDs that you have?
Yeah, we've digitally recorded some of the lectures that we're doing at the course Homeopathy by the Book. And we're going to shortly have available on CD a 3-day lecture on the assessment of the follow-up with homeopathic thinking tools. And I did a second weekend on what is characteristic, the meaning of the word, and case examples, especially from Lippe and working through those, a different weekend. And they hopefully shortly will be appearing on the website, homeopathybythebook.com.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and thank you, everybody, for being on the call.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Beautiful job. Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
It was beautiful.
Bye, Kim.